participated in the local YU programming that we've been offering over the last few months. If anything has been clear to me in this mitzvah that we found ourselves in, it's the value and the impact that YU has been having both locally and nationally under the leadership of Rabbi Berman, and mostly with the YU Mismachim here, Rabbi Leibowitz, Rabbi Tanner, Rabbi Tramp, Rabbi Axelrod, and others leading the charge. YU has really emerged as a voice of moral clarity in what's become a very muddy field in higher education, and it has been shining as the nation's flagship Jewish university. So I want to thank you all for being a part of that. If you're not on our email list or WhatsApp list, please let Jacob know before you leave today. Give him your email address or your cell phone number so you can be kept abreast of our programming happening here out of this office. We have plans for the second semester for another six-week community Beit Medrash, as well as more programs such as this, and potentially additional programs as well. We want to make sure that you're getting the information. In case nobody noticed, it is December. It's December the 5th today. And in my line of work, it's a very significant month. I work as, in addition to community programming, development professional for Yeshiva University. I want to thank many of you in this room for being among our most cherished partners and longstanding supporters. This has been a challenging year for every organization. We're all digging very deep, supporting organizations in Israel and locally. So I thank you on behalf of the Jewish nonprofit community, and I would urge you to include YU in that generosity. We have significant ongoing operational expenses. We give away $9.5 million of undergraduate scholarships to undergraduate students from Long Island. That's just Long Island. It's a $50 million, 50, scholarship budget. So every dollar that you give to YU really does go a long way to educating young men and women from this neighborhood. In addition, we have significant additional costs as a result of the war. We've increased our security budget by as much as $8 million a year. That's $8 million on top of what we were spending for security to make sure that the students and the faculty and the staff are safe. There's a lot of other costs as well. So without wanting to take advantage, I am asking you, as you consider your calendar year-end giving, to include Yeshiva University in the worthy organizations that you are supporting. And I thank you in advance. If anyone wants to talk to me about that afterwards, I'd be delighted to. The markets are up, Baruch Hashem. It's a good time to consider giving gifts of appreciated stock and avoiding capital gains tax. Not that there's anybody in this room who has to take required distributions from their IRA, but many of you might be thinking about that. Giving a qualified charitable distribution is a very tax-friendly way of supporting charity, and also, you know, making a distribution that you have to make anyway. So if you're not using your IRA distribution, talk to me about that. It can be a very easy way to give to charity as well. Okay. As I said, I'm happy to talk to you about that more after the presentation, but I don't want to take away any more time from Rabbi Leibowitz. It's now my opportunity to embarrass him for just a moment and introducing today's speaker. It's really a privilege to have Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz here with us today. He holds the Abraham Arbuckle Chair of the Director of the Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Smicha Program at Ritz. He also serves as the Mora d'Asra of the Basic Knesset of North Woodmere. He grew up in the Five Towns. He learned at Karen B'Yavna before attending YU's Sisken Sim School of Business. He's a widely published author. He's the he has 11,696 shiurim on YU Torah. That's a lot of shiurim. He's a gifted and prolific speaker with a global following. But most importantly, Rabbi Leibowitz is in charge of mentoring the next generation of rabbis that are training for their rabbanus at Yeshiva University. And that, to me, says a lot about the caliber of leadership that we not only have, but that we're producing. And we are very fortunate to have him as our de facto scholar in residence today. And I introduced Yibi Rabbi Leibowitz.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's always wonderful to be together with you. You mentioned that part of my job is to mentor the next generation of rabbis in our community. It's very humbling to have one of my rabbinic mentors, Rabbi Hain, here with us this afternoon. And I'm just a little bit nervous to speak in front of him, and so bear with me as I do my best. You know, the opportunity to get together to learn a little bit before each Yom Tov, to sort of frame the Yom Tov, is something that I enjoy very much, and I appreciate how many of you take time from your schedules to come and try to learn a little something about each Yom Tov. Now, sometimes when we learn something new, what makes it new is that it's a brand new idea. It's a concept that we haven't thought of, and it's intriguing and it's different. Sometimes, though, when we learn something new, it's not really the concept that's new. It's not a new idea, but it's a way of naming an idea that intuitively we knew existed. That sometimes just placing things in categories, knowing what to call an idea, what to call a certain concept, is very helpful in terms of clarifying our way of thinking. That's certainly the Derech HaLimud in our yeshiva, more than the chidush of some novel approach or novel idea, is the categorization, is knowing how to categorize each of the ideas that we have as we go through the sugya. Excuse me? Yeah, I'm recording, is it? So I want to share with you an idea that I saw a number of years ago from Rav Aaron Lapiansky Shlita that certainly fits into that second category of chiddush, that it's not a brand new chiddush, it's an idea that the ideas that are familiar to us, but I think naming it is very helpful. But a little bit of background before we get to that. Chanukah is a time that emphasizes a certain amount of physical beauty. In terms of how we do mitzvos, we do mitzvos in general with a certain basic level of a mitzvah and then a higher level called hidur mitzvah. Hidur mitzvah is to beautify a mitzvah. We have a nice esrog. We write a Sefer Torah. For those of you who have been privileged enough to be able to have a Sefer Torah written, you know how much time you go into investigating the sofer and the type of writing that he does, and to look at it and to make sure that it's of the utmost beauty, and then you get the nice mantle on top of the Sefer Torah. You really take care to make sure that things are beautiful. And we do that with every mitzvah. But Chanukah is unique because it's the only mitzvah that not only has a mahadrin, but has a whole nother level called mahadrin min ha-mahadrin. Someone once mentioned that maybe the reason we have a minhag to eat deep-fried foods on Chanukah, I was just in the Gourmet Glatt parking lot, and there was not a single spot available. It's a Tuesday morning. What is going on there that there's not a single spot available? Then I realized Alan's probably started selling sufganiyot, right? That's probably what did it. And so we eat deep-fried foods, whether it be latkes, whether it be sufganiyot. So someone suggested is that we want to show that we're very different than the Greeks. The Yevanim placed great emphasis on the physical body, so we eat fried foods to lay absolute waste to our physical appearance. I don't think that's exactly what the basis of the minhag is, and to the contrary, there is this emphasis certainly in the way we do the mitzvah on hidur, on a certain amount of beauty. Now, again, that notion of hidur mitzvah is operative year-round and for all mitzvos. And it could be that it's not only, as strange as it sounds, the concept of hidur may even be a requirement, that one is obligated to be mahadir a mitzvah. Meaning we would think that, no, there's the required level, and then beautifying it is just a little bit extra. It could be that hidur mitzvah ad shlish, the Gemara says, how much we have to spend on hidur mitzvah is actually a requirement, a chiyuv, an obligation to spend on beautifying a mitzvah. But the beauty that we emphasize on Chanukah is, again, on an entirely different level, because we have this idea of mahadrin min ha-mahadrin, and it certainly seems to be that it's meant to counter the influence of the Yevanim. Yafta lukim liyafes, that yafes represents a certain sense of beauty, and we represent a different kind of beauty. And therefore, we emphasize our kind of beauty in the holiday that's meant to declare and to celebrate our victory over a culture that represents another kind of beauty. You know, the thing is, though, the Hebrew language is so, so nuanced. You know, there's a sefer on Tanakh called Malbim. I'm sure you've heard of it. And the Malbim, much of what the Malbim does, not entirely, but much of what the Malbim does, is he tries to show us that words in Hebrew that you might translate, multiple words that you might translate using the same English word, actually have slightly different meanings. And if you look carefully throughout Tanakh, you'll see that they mean something a little bit different from each other. And the Hebrew language is that way. Meaning, if I were to ask you, what does the word yofi mean? When something is yafeh, when something is yofi. So that's pretty or beautiful. Good. And what is hod and hadar? What is Hadar? Also beautiful. So you have this concept of Hod v'Hadar. You have this concept of Yofi. They both seem like they're describing beauty, because when we translate something into English, the English language doesn't 100% perfectly reflect the idea that the Hebrew language is trying to teach us. So how are we to understand the difference between Yofi, Yafdelukin Liefes? The Greeks represent Yofi, and yet what we are celebrating on Hanukkah is not Yofi, but it's Hadar, it's Mahadrin, it's Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin. What exactly is the difference between those two things? You know, it's and not only is Hanukkah celebrated with a sense of Lahodos, but it's also Lahalel, like all Yom Tovim, but first Lahodos and only then Lahalel. Lahodos means to express gratitude, thanks. What does Hod, beauty, and Lahodos, to express gratitude, what do they have to do with each other? The Hebrew language is not only nuanced in that each word means something slightly different, but the connection between the words is very often something to look into. That if you have words that are very similar, that share the same shoresh as each other, usually that means something. It means that there's some real connection between the concepts that are described by very, very similar words. So point number one, again, question number one is, how are we to understand the Hadar of Hanukkah as opposed to the Yofi of Yefes, to the Yofi of Yavan? In what way are those two terms of beauty different from each other? A second question. And for this, we're going to take our focus away from Hanukkah for a moment and instead look at the Parshios that we're reading in the Torah at this time of year. We read about the courtship of Rachel, and there seems to be a lot of emphasis on Rachel's beauty. I was once speaking somewhere, and someone came over to me afterwards and asked me this question, that aren't we a religion that emphasizes Kedusha, and emphasizes Tahara, and emphasizes mitzvos, and it's what's on the inside that counts? You know, for a religion that does all that kind of emphasis, there's a lot of stuff in Tanakh about beauty. There are a lot of descriptions about, and it's not only women, although it usually is, about praising women for their beauty, and sometimes men also. For the, you have Shaul HaMelech and Yosef, certain men as well, but often a lot of emphasis on beauty. And the first place where you find that it seems to really distinguish a person, that beauty is a point of distinction for a person, I don't know if it's the first time, because you have with Sarah and Rivka also, but with Rachel, you have the distinction drawn so clearly between Rachel and Leah. That whereas Eine Leah Rakos, Leah's eyes were not as pretty for whatever reason, whether it's, as Rashi explains, because she was crying so much because she assumed that she'd be destined to spend her life and really all of eternity together with Esav. But for whatever reason, the Chumash describes that it's Eine Leah Rakos. Now, in general, if you have two siblings in a family that compare themselves to each other with any criteria, with looks, intelligence, popularity, anything, usually it's not the healthiest way to go about things, right? Meaning to define someone by, oh, you know who their brother or sister is, and you know what they're not, and you know, I remember when I applied to yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, I applied to yeshiva Keren Biavne, which is where I was privileged to attend, and my brother is 4 years older than me. He's also a much more accomplished Talmud Chacham than I am. And my brother had been in Keren Biavne 4 years earlier, and he was what I was always constantly told, he was a legend in Keren Biavne. He would sit in the Beis Medrash all day, all night, and just an absolute masmid. He was an absolute fixture of the Beis Medrash in the yeshiva. So I remember I was a little self-conscious about applying to the same yeshiva. I actually went to a different high school than my brother because of that reason. And I was a little self-conscious to be in the same, applying to the same yeshiva. But it was 4 years ago. You know, they probably forgot about him by now. I figured, like, there's no way they remember him. You know, there's so many guys come through. They're not going to, you know, they're not going to look at me and think of him. So I sit down for my bechina with Rabbi Lachman Shlita, and it was two guys. It was me and Daniel Kamenetsky taking over. That's Rabbi Kamenetsky's brother, another person with a famous brother, and we sat down for our bechina. And I'm thinking, okay, now I'm safe because I'm with Daniel Kamenetsky. So if they pick on anyone's brother, it's going to be him. And Rabbi Lachman asked Daniel a question, and while he's waiting for Daniel to find the answer, he turns to me and he says, "So Leibowitz, are you a masmid like your brother?" and I said, "I don't think it's so healthy for brothers to compare themselves to each other so much, so I try not to think about it." He likes the little sparring. So he said, "All right, fair enough. Are you a masmid?" So I said, maybe better to ask that question to my rebbeim rather than to me. And you know, I figured at that point I had the upper hand, right? Meaning I that was a sharp answer on the spot. And he said, "You're not answering because of anivus or because of sheker." So, you know what? I'm never going to win this. I said, "I just don't know." But in general, when you have two siblings with each other, it's not a great idea for the siblings to always measure them. So it's natural to want to do that, but it's usually not a great idea to try to measure them against each other. And yet, the Torah is very much not shy about contrasting these two sisters, Rachel and Leah, when it very succinctly says, "Ve'ene Leah Rachos, ve'Rachel ha'isa yifas tovar v'yifas mara," that Rachel was the pretty sister, she was the beautiful sister, and Leah wasn't. And it's literally in one sentence in the Torah where that contrast is drawn. Even more troubling is why it matters. I mean, if you're going to contrast them in terms of their accomplishments in Kiyumei HaMitzvos, in fulfilling Mitzvos Hashem, their accomplishments in Chesed, their accomplishments in any area of life, that's a genuine accomplishment. Beauty is not at all an accomplishment. It's something that's either God-given or God didn't give. And it makes it sound like Yaakov was a guy who took one look at the picture on the shidduch resume. You know, for those, I guess he paskin that you should put a picture on the shidduch resume. I always tell my talmidim, don't ask for a picture on the shidduch resume, and no one listens. So he's the one guy that took a look at the. He's that guy that took a look at the picture on the shidduch resume, and that made his decision right there. That he saw the picture, he saw the beauty. What exactly is the Torah telling us about the role of beauty in Shiduchim and in Yiddishkeit, when the Torah, in describing why Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel, chooses to emphasize Rachel's beauty in contrast to Leah? And a third question. In these parshios, we read about Yosef HaTzadik. Starting with Parshas Vayeshev, the emphasis switches pretty much to Yosef HaTzadik and to his story, and particularly of his rivalry with the children of Leah, Reuven, from whom he wanted the Bechora, and Yehuda, who stood up to him. Yosef is one of the few people in our history who we refer to as HaTzadik. To earn the title HaTzadik, you know, that's just the way he's referred to, you would imagine one has to do something pretty special. And yet, when the Torah describes Yosef, more than it emphasizes his tzidkus, it emphasizes his physical beauty, his good looks. Ve'yihi Yosef yifei toar v'yifei mara. That Yosef was very beautiful. It even seems like at key moments in his life, his physical beauty is incorporated into the story, almost like unnecessarily, that each time something happens important in Yosef's life, there's some reminder of, or some emphasis that's placed on his physical beauty. V'hu na'ar, at the beginning of Parshas Vayeshev, Rashi tells us, ha'isa misalsel b'sa'aro, that he was curling his hair, which means that unlike most young Jewish men, he was not suffering from male pattern baldness, right? He was misalsel b'sa'aro. He had this beautiful locks of hair. I guess you could say it means his payas, and he was curling his payas, but I don't think the Hasidic movement had started yet at that point, so I don't know if we can interpret it that way. Misalsel b'sa'aro, he's curling his hair. He had this beautiful, beautiful hair. before overcoming the challenge of Eishes Potiphar, which was certainly no small challenge, we're told, Vi Yosef, Yifei Tor, Vifei Mare. Okay, it fits in that story, that seems important in that story, because she was interested in him for some reason, and the Chumash seems to be describing the reason, but the reason seems to be his beauty. And that heroic moment where we have that shalshelas that describes his refusal to succumb to her advances, it only happens because he's such a good-looking guy. Because he's the kind of person that looks the way that she would be interested in. Before meeting Paro, when he's taken out of the Egyptian jail, we're not told all that much about his preparations to meet Paro, other than he put himself together. Yeah, he got a haircut, he took a bath, a shave, he made sure to look nice before he goes and he meets Paro. We're not told like what sort of mental preparation he did, what sort of religious preparation he did. We're told about how he physically prepared to look nice when he goes to meet Paro. What exactly is the connection between the success of Yosef and beauty? So to quickly review, three questions. One Chanukah related, two Parsha related. First question, Chanukah related, that there's this emphasis on Hod, Hadar, Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin, and in what way is that different than Yafta Lukim LeYafes, than the Yofi of Yafes? And second question, Parsha related, why is it that when we read about Rachel and Leah, the contrast between them is in their beauty, and the Chumash Dafka draws our attention to that? And third, why is it that Yosef is so, that so many of the details of the story of Yosef revolve around his physical attractiveness, how good-looking he was. So the idea that I want to share with you is, again, it's a fairly simple idea. It's not complex, but I think the Chiddush is in just being able to name things, just being able to identify categories. And this idea that I saw from Rav Aaron Lapiansky, Shlita, the Rashiva in Greater Washington, Yeshiva of Greater Washington. And Rav Lapiansky explains that there are actually three types of beauty in this world. You know, where I come from, in the Yeshiva, we learn in the Brisker tradition. And the way that the Briskers learn is that we typically break things down into two categories. Right? We take an idea that seems like it's one idea and say, no, there are really two concepts being described over here. There's what we call tzvei dinim. There's a din in the gavra, a din in the cheftza, a din in the maisa, a din in the kiyum. There's a way to categorize things in two categories. Remember, I once mentioned that in the shir. I said, where I come from, you know, we always start with a Rambam or something. And my brother heard the shir and he texted me. He said, you're from Lawrence. You're not from Bris. Where do you think you come from? But it's interesting. I was just reading the biography of Rav Nata Greenblatt, Zichrono Livracha. They just put out a biography. Art School published a biography of Rav Nata Greenblatt. And in the first, who my brother was very close with, and in the first chapter of the biography, it said that Rav Nata considered himself a Brisker, even though he was born in Washington, D.C. So it's okay for one to consider themselves as an intellectual heir, I guess, to a certain tradition. But we typically define things in two categories. You know, there's a wonderful sefer written by Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, Zichrono Livracha, and it's a sefer called Ishim Vishitos. And what he does, it's a very interesting idea. He takes a collection of gedolim from the past 300 years. I think it's about 10 or 12 different gedolim from the past 300 years. And he writes not a biography of the gedolim, but a biography of their brains, so to speak. Meaning he describes their unique way of learning, their unique way of thinking, and he gives examples of what made them unique in their style of learning. So he has 10, 15, 20 pages on all of the different gedolim, except on the Ragged Shavar Gaon. The Ragged Shavar Gaon, he had like 80 pages on, because as a young man, he was a Lubavitcher Chassid, and then, as was the Ragged Shavar, and he spent time in the Ragged Shavar's house. He was a Ben Bayis by the Gaon Rav Yosef Rosen, the Ragged Shavar Gaon, in the town of Dvinsk. And he describes over there that one of the unique characteristics and hallmarks of the Rogatchover's way of thinking is that whereas in Brisk we divide things into two categories, the Rogatchover would often divide things into three categories. For example, he said, the mitzvah of bris milah. So we think of it as, oh, there's a bris. Okay, there's a mitzvah of a bris milah. So a brisker might say, no, there's a mitzvah of milah, and there's an iser to be an orel. An orel, someone who doesn't have a milah, is not allowed to partake of Karban Pesach. There are certain halachos that relate to an orel. The Rogatchover said, no, there's a mitzvah to do a milah, there's a mitzvah to have a milah, and there's an iser to be an arel. And he explained a whole bunch of different halachos based on that categorization. I'm not getting into any of that right now. This is my long way of saying that Rav Lapiansky has three categories of beauty. I could have just said the number three. I could have used three fingers to describe what we're about to do. Even if I was Elmo, I had enough fingers to, right? Three categories of beauty. What are the three categories of beauty? So first, we have a kind of yofi that is purely external, something that appears attractive from the outside, but it has no inner value. Sheker achein vehevel hayofi. It's a false advertisement. The mashal I use is there's a company called Jelly Belly. Right? Yeah. So they have jelly beans that are delicious. They're much better than other jelly beans. It's just a fact. They also produce a kind of jelly bean that looks just like the good ones, but they have like these awful flavors. I forgot what they're called. Anyone, you know what I'm talking about, though, right? It's like a gag product. So you have two Jelly Bellies that look exactly the same, and one is lemon lime, and the other one is vomit. Right, meaning that's the way it's, and you don't know what you're getting. It looks just like the most delicious jelly bean in the world, but you don't know exactly until you bite into it whether what you're about to taste is something that's going to be absolutely disgusting. Sheker achein vehevel hayofi. Sometimes something looks beautiful on the outside; it looks fantastic, but as soon as you bite into it, as soon as you dig in a little bit deeper, you find that it's the vomit-flavored jelly belly; that it's not good at all. A fruit that looks delicious but is in fact poisonous. There are people like that. There are people that have this kind of yofi. I don't just mean like Hollywood types and things like that. There are people who look kind and sweet from their external appearance. But it's like the Chazar showing his split hooves. Look at me, I'm kosher, when you know that he's the epitome of treif, because dafka because he pretends to be kosher. And this is even true of Torah knowledge, which is a little bit of a chiddush. But the Gemara says, Kol Talmud Chacham She'ein Bo Deya, Afilu Nevela Tova Hemen, that any Talmud Chacham who doesn't have Deya. Now, deya could mean a number of different things. Deya might mean knowledge. The Rambam has a section of Mishnah Torah called Hilchos Deyos, and he often describes Deyos. When the Rambam uses the term deya, he typically means midos. Midos tovos, to have fine character. So, kol Talmud Chacham shein bo deya, how could you be a Talmud Chacham and not have knowledge? That's what the word Talmud Chacham means, that you have the knowledge. So kol tam chacham shein bo deya likely means a tam chacham who doesn't have refined character, who doesn't have proper midos, who is perhaps cruel or crass or arrogant. So afilu nevela tove hemenu. A nevela means a carcass of an animal that didn't even enjoy the benefit of shechita, just a dead animal, a hunted animal, is better than such a tam chacham. A Talmud Chacham that doesn't have Midos Tovos. Now, people make the mistake of thinking that somebody who knows a lot of Torah, but is not a kind person, is not a good person, he has one quality, and he's lacking in another quality. He has one great quality that he's a Talmud Chacham, and he's lacking in the quality in terms of his personal character. That is not true. That is not true. If a person is a Talmud Chacham, She'in Bodeya, Afilu Nevela Tova Hemenu means that his knowledge becomes something that is disgusting, something that you can't admire. To the contrary, his knowledge is something that that is more reason to disrespect a person like that. His maila is his chisaron. that which we would think sets him apart in a positive way, in fact sets him apart in a negative way. After all, isn't his knowledge now a great chilul Hashem? Because if people look at this person and they think, this is a Talmud Chacham, this is someone who's full of Torah, and this is what the Torah represents, so now his knowledge became a chilul Hashem. I gave a shiur recently on the obligation that the Jewish people have to make every sort of effort possible to help Klal Yisrael in a time of tzara. And by every sort of effort possible, I mean obviously to daven, obviously to learn, obviously to give tzedakah, but also I mean to rally and to use diplomacy and to do everything we can, every possible tool that we have at our disposal. We're supposed to, in our yeshiva, after shir one day, our Rosh Yeshiva, primarily Rav Shechtner of Tversky, had instructed every Rebbe in the yeshiva to tell the Talmidim, don't go anywhere, take out your phones. We assume they have phones. Take out your phones, and we gave out the numbers of local congressmen, and call and say thank you to those who are supporting Israel. Usually you get a machine and you can just leave the message, and they just tally the numbers, meaning it's important to know that they're getting these phone calls. And that's part of, it's one of the beliefs of our yeshiva, and I think a belief of traditional Judaism, is that you have to do a hishtadlus. So I gave this shir, and I said that I spoke about pretty passionately about that belief of the importance of hishtadlus on a physical level as well as on a spiritual level. And I mentioned at the end of the shiur that, having said all that, I heard from Rav Asher Weiss Shlita in the name of his great Rebbe, the Kleisenberger Rebbe, and he said that his Rebbe, the Kleisenberger Rebbe, was a absolute kana'i. He was vicious in his attacks of people sometimes. He was someone who had his opinions, and he expressed them in the most direct ways possible sometimes. But at a time of war, the Kleisenberger Rebbe held that one is never allowed to speak ill of another Jew. At a time of war, we need to figure out a way to not speak ill of any other Jew. Even the Kleisenberger Rebbe, who was so vicious sometimes in his in expressing his opinion. So I was very moved by that comment of Rav Asher Weiss, because I had just spent the better part of a week after the rally speaking ill of a lot of other Jews, who I was pretty upset about. And like it sort of, you know, so it changed my way of thinking. So when I mentioned that in the shiur, I said that while there are people who are Gedolei Torah, who are considered Gedolei Torah, who have said things or done things that I have considered to be incorrect, and in certain instances even callous, it's not the time. It's not the time to focus on that right now. It's the time to focus on what can we do. What can we do well? What's the next up? What's the next effort we can make for Klal Yisrael? Mm-hmm. So I received an email from someone saying, "Dear Rabbi Leibowitz," I don't have the email printed out over here, but it's something along the lines of, "You know, I enjoy listening to your shiurim. I'm a Haredi Jew from wherever, and just last week I was complimenting you to my yeshiva bacher friends, and then you said something that made my skin crawl that I just couldn't tolerate, and I feel like I have to tell you something. Yeah, I have to make a macha, I have to make an objection, I have to object to it, and I have to speak my mind. You said that Gedolei Yisrael have said things that you would consider callous? How could you use the word callous when describing Gedolei Yisrael?" So I responded that I was not referring, when I used that word, I was not referring to people who said not to go to a rally. I think they're wrong, and that's okay. People are allowed to think other people are wrong. I said I was referring to people who said more objectionable things, things that I'd rather not even repeat right now or ever, but I mentioned in the email. And that I found to be callous. And the fellow responded, "What do you mean? No one said those things." I said, "Okay, so we're in agreement." And then 5 minutes later, I got an email from him. I Googled it. I found it. It makes me nauseous. I apologize. I hope you're mochel me. Meaning, there are certain things that express such a lack of midos, such a lack of das that the wisdom, the Torah wisdom that a person might have, becomes his greatest fault, not his greatest maila. It's not something to admire anymore. A Talmud Chacham she'en bo deya afilu nevela tovei menu, because he has the worst kind of beauty. It's a beauty that expresses itself. It says, look at my razor sharp intellect. Look at the shiurim I can give, and you're going to be so taken by that. And then you know what? I'm going to sneak in sinas Yisrael. I'm going to sneak in all the worst midos possible, and that's the worst kind of beauty. It's a type of yofi that's purely on the outside. It's attractive, but then you go a little bit further, and it shows you something very ugly that lies underneath. You know, I heard somebody in the aftermath of an episode, another terrible episode in recent history, of a popular children's author who was guilty of doing terrible, terrible things in the Jewish community. So I heard someone assessing the situation, and the person said that this is an example of Or v'choshech mishtamshim be'ervuvia, of light and darkness working together within the same person. He had so much light, the beautiful books that he wrote, that he taught children, so many good things, and darkness working at the same time. And I argued that is not Or v'choshech mishtamshim be'ervuvia. The light was the darkness. The light was the darkness. It made the darkness even darker, because the light was how one attracts people in order to influence them with the darkness, in order to impose the darkness on them. I think sometimes you have a type of yofi, and all these examples are mine, they are not Rav Lapiansky's examples, I don't want to hold him guilty of my own opinion, but there is sometimes a type of yofi, a type of beauty, that because it's so external, is a fault. It's not a mile, it's not a good thing. That's one type of yofi. But then, there's a second type of yofi. And that is a genuine yofi. A kind of beauty that draws our attention to very valuable content. That it might have gone unnoticed had it not been for the external beauty. But once you're attracted by that external beauty, and you look more carefully, you find even more beauty beneath the surface. And that's a very special type of beauty. A sefer that has a beautiful cover on it. Don't judge a book by its cover. Every publisher will tell you that everybody judges a book by its cover. So they make a beautiful cover for the book. Why? So that someone will look at that and they'll say, oh, that looks like a beautiful book. And then they open it up and it actually is. And it has so much wisdom inside of it. And there's so much to gain from it. We dress up Sifrei Torah in beautiful mantles. You know, I was recently looking into buying a mantle for a Sifrei Torah. Someone asked me to look into it. They cost a lot of money. Sometimes these nice covers for Sifrei Torah cost a couple of $1,000 sometimes if you get the really, really fancy ones. Why would you spend that on just a cover of a Sifrei Torah? Because it's drawing your attention to an even greater beauty that's on the inside, usually. Hopefully the people buying the expensive mantles also didn't go cheap on the Sefer Torah. I was once at Achnas Sefer Torah, and the sofer was schmoozing with me, so I didn't really have much to talk to him about, so I said, oh, is it a nice Sefer Torah? And I figured, you know, that's an easy, simple question. And he said, no, they didn't pay for a nice Sefer Torah, they paid for a kosher Sefer Torah. I said, okay, didn't need to know that. There's that kind of beauty. You know, there's a halacha that the shul should be the most impressive structure in the neighborhood, that it should be the most beautiful. Why? So there are many reasons, but one basic reason is let it be something that draws people's attention, and then they'll want to go inside of it. They'll want to see what's in there, and what's going to be in there is something even greater. And that's the concept of Hidur Mitzvah. The concept of Hidur Mitzvah is a second kind of yofi. Yofi is a physical beauty, but this is a physical beauty that's meant to be a reflection of an even greater beauty on the inside. And then third category of beauty is an entirely different kind of beauty. And that's what we call Hadar. Sometimes the value of the inside exceeds the outside packaging, so much so that it's as though the bag, the packaging, is straining to hold its contents. Like the beauty is so great, it's bulging out and tearing apart the seams of that which tries to contain it. an example of such beauty is Eretz Yisrael, the beauty of Eretz Yisrael. Do you know that there are people, it's unimaginable for us because we're so attuned to the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, but there are people that actually go to Israel and say, oh, a bunch of rocks. You know, this isn't like, the Grand Canyon or, I don't know, whatever other beautiful, a bunch of rocks. But Eretz Yisrael is described as Eretz HaTzvi. Why is it called Eretz HaTzvi? So the Chazal describe that a tzvi is unique. A deer is a very unique kind of animal in that the deer's skin looks like it's too small on the animal. It can't. It's as if it can't contain all the muscles or the inside of the deer. It's so tightly wrapped on the animal. It's like the suit after Yantif. Right? That's the Eretz HaTzvi. That it's as and that's symbolic of Eretz Yisrael. That there's so much beauty in Eretz Yisrael that anything in the physical world cannot contain that beauty, and it's bulging out of this physical land. That's Eretz HaTzvi. It's the beauty of a great tzaddik very often. Rav Moshe Feinstein was a little Jew. He was a sweet little Jew. There is nothing in the physical world that could properly express the beauty of Rav Moshe Feinstein. The beauty of a neshama of Rav Moshe Feinstein. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu put him in this little tiny package. This biggest neshama in this little tiny package. There are architects, there are different types of architects. I don't know much about architecture, but I remember seeing a house that looked like it had a door and nothing else. Like a front door. And someone said, oh, that house is like, it's a mansion. The architect built it into the side of a mountain where all you see is like the front door, and then you go in and it's like four levels down along the side of the mountain with the views to die for and the swimming pools in the back and everything. You only see a little bit, but then when you look further in, you see that it's so much greater. The first two categories are different types of yofi. The third is what we call hod or hadar. The reason Moshe Rabbeinu had karnei ha-hod is because his spiritual level was such that it could not be contained in a physical body. Human eyes couldn't look at Moshe Rabbeinu when he came down from Har Sinai because he had karnei ha-hod. What does karnei ha-hod mean? I'm not sure exactly, but I know that he had to wear a veil because a human eye couldn't behold it. It was too big. It was too beautiful. It was too dazzling. Yavan was endowed with great yofi, but it was the first kind of yofi. When Daniel, Sefer Daniel, Perek Yud, describes Yavan, he says, "Vahodi nefach alai l'mashchis." The hod of Klal Yisrael is destroyed by the Greeks and all of their yofi. Now, when you look at Leah and Rachel represent hod and yofi respectively. But Rachel had the good kind of yofi. So again, there's the bad kind of yofi, the kind of yofi that reflects, that lures you in only to discover some very, very dark things underneath the surface, and that's Yavan. And then you have the good kind of yofi that attracts you so that you can look further and look deeper and realize that there's even more beauty there. And then there's Hod, where nothing much to look at on the outside. But on the inside, there's a beauty that belies that defies the imagination, considering what you're able to witness on the outside. Leah is not a Yafei Toar. But Eine Leah Rakos, on the simplest level, means she had very soft eyes. Her eyes were beautiful, because they're the window to something more internal. Leah is overcome with Hoda'a, the Mida that's expressed when our inner feelings cannot be adequately described by our outer expressions. Leah has a descendant, David HaMelech, the small son of Yishai who gets overlooked. How overlooked does David get? Well, Shmuel is told that there's going to be a king. You're going to have to appoint the next king. Do it quietly because Shaul may not be too happy about this, right? You're going to have to find... And he's a son of Yishai. So Shmuel goes and he figures, okay, I just need to interview all the sons of Yishai and see which one is fit to be king. And he interviews all the sons of Yishai, and none of them are the right guy. And there's one son that he didn't interview yet. And Shmuel says, oh, I guess they didn't find him. Call it a day. You know that it has to be a son of Yishai. You've interviewed all but one. He doesn't even think to look at David. It can't possibly be David. David's out somewhere else. He's an abandoned son. He's the rejected one. Whatever the history is, there may be the Midrashim say more of a sordid history and where he came from exactly. David is he's out. He's not even something you would think about for Malchus. David comes from Leah. He has a certain hod, a certain hadar. Rachel, on the other hand, represents Yofi. The second type of Yofi that we described before. She's the Yefas Toar. She's the mother of Yosef. She's the matriarch of the family that produced Shaul. Shaul HaMelech, we know, was Mishichma L'mayla Mikala'am. He was tall and imposing and handsome. And when people would talk to him, when women would talk to him, they would try to make the conversation as long as they possibly can, just so that they could sit there looking at him. That's not me saying that. Chazal say that. A tzaddik gomer is the epitome of Yofi. He never sinned. His external actions are a reflection of a pristine and pure neshama. A bal tshuva is a reflection of hod. Because he's flawed on the outside. His high school friends remember what he used to do. They remember, oh, remember that time. Now he's a big rabbi. Oh, come on. He's flawed on the outside, but something inside of him is pushing him to rise up, to do tshuva, to enhance his spiritual personality. Yosef is a tzaddik because he never, ever succumbed to the pressures of Eshes Potiphar. Yehuda is a bal tshuva because he did succumb. He sinned with Tamar. Yosef is Yofi. Yehuda is Hod. Even the letters of Yehuda's name bear that out. On Chanukah, we celebrate the defeat of the wrong kind of Yofi by emphasizing Hod and Hadar. We not only have Hidur in Chanukah, we have Mahadrin, Mina Mahadrin. That which we see in the physical world is just the tip of the iceberg as far as the beauty that lies beneath. On Chanukah, it's first Lahodos and then Lahalo. We need to have the Hod first. Physical limitations do not constrict us on Chanukah. What do we celebrate when we say Al Anisim that we won a war? Giborim biyad chalashim, that the weak defeated the strong. Rabim biyad ma'atim, the few defeated the many. In the physical world, that shouldn't happen. It doesn't make sense that that would happen. A single jug of oil lasts for 8 days. In the physical world, that doesn't happen. What does that represent, that a single jug of oil lasts for 8 days? It represents that in the physical world, it looks like it's this much, but there's more there that you can't see, that you can't see at first glance. There's more potential latent than we can possibly perceive. It's struggling to come out. Agav, I saw a beautiful vart. It says we also celebrate Rishayim biyad tzaddikim. And one of the miracles is that the tzaddikim defeated the Rishayim. So I just saw Rabbi Emanuel Bernstein in one of his svarim raises the question, why is that miraculous? For the weaklings to beat up the strong ones is miraculous. For the few to defeat the many is miraculous. What is my personal righteousness? In what way is that a disadvantage in a fight? Why would the Rishon biyat tzaddikim, Tumeim biyat tahorin, Zaydin biyat oskei sorasech, why would any of that be a disadvantage? So he quoted Rav Elchanan Wasserman, I saw it quoted from others as well in more recent days, an unbelievable idea. And something that really resonates nowadays, that when a person is engaged in a battle, if they're a tzaddik, they follow the rules of warfare. And that puts them at a disadvantage. If they're a Rasha, they ignore the rules of warfare. And that gives them a certain military advantage. So part of what we're celebrating is Rishayim biyat tzaddikim, that we prevailed even though we fought the right way. We were being tzaddikim in the way that we were fighting our battles, and we still prevailed, even though that's a military disadvantage. Purim is recorded in Tanakh. It's given a physical place in a scroll. Chanukah is not in Tanakh. It's not even in Mishnah. There's no Maseches Chanukah. It's a couple of dapim in Maseches Shabbos as an afterthought in the second parak of Maseches Shabbos. There's no shell that holds this idea. There's no externality at all to the idea of Hanukkah. It is a beauty that's beneath the surface. Each of the Yom Tovim, Midoraisa and Midrabanan, are represented by one of the seven mashkim, one of the Zayin mashkim that are machshir lekabel tumah, one of the seven liquids. Pesach is represented by dam, because dam Pesach, the blood of the Korban Pesach. Sukkos, mayim. Why Sukkos mayim? Nisuch hamayim is the primary celebration on Sukkos. Shavuos, what liquid is Shavuos? Milk. It's the milch ha-giyantiv. Rosh Hashanah? Honey, of course. Yom Kippur is dew. Okay, we'll have to get to why that is. Not for now. Purim is represented by Yayin, of course. Chayavinish levesume. And Chanukah? Oil. By Shemen. Now, the very character of Shemen, if you think about it, is that such a bitter fruit, and with apologies to those who enjoy eating olives, you're just wrong, they're disgusting. But I'm sorry. That's such a... I can't. If I eat an olive, I'm nauseous the rest of the day. That's such a bitter fruit actually carries within it the most valuable of all the mashkim. The Gemara assumes consistently throughout Shas that oil is more expensive than wine. It was a greater commodity than wine. The most valuable. The Gemara consistently assumes that way, because that's what Chanukah is. Chanukah is, on the outside, it's not much to look at, it's not much to taste, there's not much beauty there. But there's so much there. You just have to look a little bit further. And in relationships, the initial attraction happens with Yofi, but hopefully as a relationship develops, it turns into an attraction of Hod. It forms a connection that defies beauty, as the external youthful beauty may fade and it's replaced by a much, much deeper and more important connection. So as we celebrate Chanukah, perhaps one thing to think about is how in this world some of the most beautiful things are things that cannot be seen easily on the surface. And therefore, when there are people that describe what they see, or that describe their impressions, what they're describing very often is something very external. Whether it be in world events, whether it be about individual people, they're describing something very external. And sometimes in order to appreciate the real beauty of something, you need to really get into the kishkas. You need to really see. Now, I was in Eretz Yisrael recently, a couple of weeks ago. I think every rabbi I know was in Eretz Yisrael a couple of weeks, within the past few weeks. I feel like there's a unit of the army called Sanchanim, and there's Givati and Golani, and I think there's a unit of the army that just dances with American rabbis. Sings Am Yisrael Chai with American rabbis. It's like, you're too overweight to fight. Go dance with an American rabbi. But when I was there, it happened to be I was not on a mission trip. I was on a regular trip for the yeshiva. So I went and I gave shiurim in a bunch of different places. In 4 days, I gave something like 23 shiurim in different yeshivas and seminaries. But it wasn't like one of these intense mission trips. It's, the intensity was just by talking to people, to my friends who are rebbeim in yeshiva. Hey, what's doing? How's everything going? And one friend of mine who, a regular American guy, grew up rooting for the Mets and the Yankees, what's doing? Oh yeah, things are great. We're hosting a family of 10 from Ashkelon that's living with us for over a month. They're Sephardi Haredim. They don't speak a word of English. The kids have never been to Yerushalayim before, because who could afford the bus fare to Yerushalayim for over a month? Yeah, my kids moved out of their bedroom, so they're all bunking up. Like, there's a beauty that can only be seen when you're there. And I said something, and this I'll close now. I realize I went a little longer than I thought, and I think longer than my meter allows me to outside also. I said in my last stop in a shul called Mishkan Shiloh in Shechunat Yeshivat Levatorah in Ramat Beit Shemesh, I said, the achdus here is mind blowing. The chesed is unbelievable. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. And a woman came over to me afterwards and she said, "You're such an American." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Look, you spoke nicely, and we really appreciate it. We thank you so much." But you're talking like words like achdus and chesed. Chesed is something you do with somebody else. Achdus is like when two different pieces come together. This isn't chesed, it's not achdus. This is Am Yisrael. And like I realized, like I thought I was giving the biggest compliment I knew how to give. And I was introduced to an entirely different level. There's something called Am Yisrael. And you can't see that on the outside. That's a Chanukah kind of beauty. That's a Hod, that's a Hadar. That's something that needs to be lived and experienced to really appreciate it. And we should see much more of that Am Yisrael, because we know it's that feeling of Am Yisrael, that sense of being completely a single unit who serves HaKadosh Baruch Hu together, that ultimately is going to bring us toward a Geula that we should celebrate together. Amen.